sleep, Mom. Come on, go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
You know how to get involved in the show. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com, like Joseph, who wrote to say, I was trying to tell a friend of mine last week at work that Bob Dylan almost got arrested once for creeping on Bruce Springsteen's house.
Yeah.
What? And he didn't believe me. Do I believe you? I don't know. Will you please set the record straight and prove that I didn't entirely make this up?
I love that Joseph wrote this letter.
He didn't entirely make it up.
Well, right. Okay, so looking into this, Joseph, let me tell you up top. The details you're giving here are a little out of place. But as bizarre as this sounds, you're not entirely off. Okay, you're not entirely delusional. This actually almost came up on the show once before.
Yeah, and I always had heard about this of him
going
to
the house.
Yeah, it's like it's bounced around, but okay. I never really knew. But like this wasn't the motorcycle.
No,
accident.
So we've done a few Bob Dylan episodes. We did Bob Dylan versus Jesus Christ, one of my all-time favorite episodes. We also did the one about the motorcycle accident, and we got into talking about how he is a master of his own lore. Like he does a bunch of weirdo stuff all the time, and so. I think after the motorcycle accident episode, Leif, the producer, and I did a bonus episode that I don't think you were on.
Right.
And Leif had compiled all of this stuff in the aftermath of that episode from stuff people had sent in and things that we had found of sort of his eccentricities, weird things that Dylan had done. So there was a passing reference on that episode, literally for probably like 15 seconds, where we mentioned that one time he got mistaken for being a homeless person in New Jersey.
Yes.
And that was like maybe 15 years ago, but there's a lot more to that story. That's, I think, what Joseph is talking about, and we didn't really flesh that story out. So it's both funny and has a real meaningful element to it, which I think is neat. So I think that's what we're going to tackle today. But let me start here before we do that. Let me just,
sure.
I'm curious about your response to this. If Bob Dylan was just out walking around in your neighborhood, outside your house right now, A, do you think you'd recognize him? B, would you call the cops? C, what if it was raining?
I've imagined this, what this would be like. Okay, ready? So I get a feeling that I need to look out the window. So I look through the blinds.
You take us there.
And there's Bob Dylan standing out in galoshes near my backyard. And then it starts raining.
Yeah.
And then
a hard rain's going to fall.
And no, it starts raining. Good try. It starts raining, and then it's things have changed, and he's lip syncing it like he's on Solid Gold or American Bandstand.
So, if it's raining, are there rainy day women, and which numbers are they?
See, there's so many rain songs for him, and I thought I was just gonna be like, you know, well, look, it's raining and things have changed. Like that's what I imagine him. But it seems like if he was a peeper, he would be a creepy peeper.
Yeah. There's a couple parts to this.
Oh,
walk
yeah.
us through this.
Yeah. There's two. The first one is in Long Branch, New Jersey, which is July 23rd, 2009.
And it is raining. That's why we're talking about the rain. There's folks in a neighborhood in Long Branch, New Jersey, who see this dude who appears old and somewhat disheveled shuffling around outside a house that has a for sale sign on it, on their street. And he's looking in the windows. Apparently, which, I mean, I guess is standard practice if you're curious about a house that's for sale, but also makes you look weird. And they don't know what's going on, so they figure it would be best if they call the police.
Right, so they put out a call to see who is on the squad closest to that house, and the person that they find is 24-year-old officer named Christy Bubble.
I love that it's a 24-year-old woman who ends up with this call. So she takes it, she drives the streets over, she's like just a few blocks away. Pretty quickly, she sees this guy in question.
Yeah, and everybody get ready to get loose because Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is about to get funny. This is what she says. He's wearing sweatpants tucked into his rain boots, and he has two rain jackets on.
Two rain jackets.
Well, sometimes it gets really wet. So she rolls up on him and starts asking him questions. Hey, sir, what is your name? And he says, Bob Dylan.
Now, this is a direct quote from Christy. He's saying these things that are normal indicators of liars. Quote, I'm Bob Dylan. So I say, okay, what's your real name? And he tells me his real name, and his real name, his government name, I think it's like Zimmerman, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's totally weird too. That's not right. He has two names. Some other kid, this is her quote, some other kid came and backed me up, so another young cop, and he was my age, and he didn't believe the guy either.
So imagine Bob Dylan going on a peeper right now, like this weekend, and someone calls the cops on him, like this weekend, and a 20-something-year-old police officer comes up and starts asking him questions. He would go to jail because he's totally weird, and he has two names.
Well,
and I've got, you know, he's got other stuff.
That's the funniest part about this whole thing. A couple years after this, a writer at Esquire will let this officer just sit down and tell the story and just basically put it all in her words. And as you can imagine, she does take a little bit of time defending herself when she's given this opportunity because she knows she comes off like a real dumbass in the way that this all unfolds. But this is what she says. Read that.
Yeah, this is from her. They made it seem like I was some dumb girl who didn't know who he was and had never heard of him, and that's not the case. My dad, he passed away 6 years ago, but he used to love Bob Dylan. My mom listened to him. I knew who he was, but I wasn't sitting around looking at a picture of him every day, and that makes sense.
That makes sense. Like, I often think this, like, if you saw a famous person in public, with the exception of a few people, I think a lot of times, unless they're just this top-level celebrity, you will sort of second-guess yourself and be like, well, that's probably not really them. And then also, do you really know, even famous people who you might appreciate, do you really know what they look like? You know?
I mean,
Bob Dylan, do you really know what he looks like right now? Unless you're me and you. I know we do.
Yeah.
But just the average person.
I don't think so. Well, I don't think he's a very public figure.
Well, yeah. Okay. So, and this is what makes this story so hilarious, because when she tells this story beat for beat and how it unfolds, I actually can totally see where on most days you kind of just think you have a delusional unhoused man on your hands.
Yeah. But it's Bob Dylan.
But
so every answer that he gives
sounds like, fake.
They do sound fake, but they're true. So like she asked him where he lives, and he said, I have houses all over the place. I don't live in one place. I travel a lot. I have a house in London. I have a house in California.
She also asks him where he's staying at one point. Oh, it's this hotel by the ocean. Like, again, just like this vague, of course it is.
He gets in the car, and then this is where, to me, I would think, like, yeah, this guy's full of shit. Because he says, just take me over there. I'll give you tickets to my show. You can see me play. I remember hearing that, and I thought, this guy is crazy.
And then the story gets extra fun because Dylan's manager shows up.
That's right. And managers are my favorite part of
rock and roll
bedtime stories, because there is anger, there is money laundering and drugs and fights and all the things that...
In this case, though, it looks to be mostly just anger. Read that direct quote.
Right. As we got to the hotel, his manager came running out to us and flipped out. Being a total jerk, he grabbed Bob out of the car, which is crazy, and said, don't talk to them anymore. Come with me. And I was like, sorry, Bob. The manager was a pompous asshole. And I go, whoa, we're still the cops. Give us some form of ID or we're going to come to your bus. And he says, you don't have a warrant. Don't come on this bus. And I was like, we're not trying to do all this. Just tell us who he is and we'll get moving. What a great story.
So have you ever thought about, I've probably asked you this before, if you needed a manager, who you would hire as your manager? Like, if you had to pick someone you already know in your life, who would you hire as your manager? And I think this is a fun question because it's kind of a way of saying, who is someone who you trust and who cares about you and is loyal, but is also kind of an asshole?
Oh.
Because like, you don't want your nicest friend.
But the last thing.
Right. I don't think I'd be enough of an asshole to be your manager.
Yeah, and I don't know. I guess I don't know.
And likewise about you. I don't think you'd be enough of an asshole to be my manager.
You know what? 20 years ago, I would have been a great manager.
20 years
for
ago,
you.
Murdoch would have been my manager.
Yeah, I was a very angry prick.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know who I would get.
I used to always say, I shared an office with a buddy of mine way back in the day who was a little bit older than me and was kind of a mentor to me. His name was Chris. And I would often say that Chris would be my manager. Now, it's been many years on, I might call my lawyer friend, Colin. We've been best friends since high school. And he is very, very loyal, and he is not afraid to get in a fight on my behalf. So
I think I know.
Okay.
Well, I'd either ask Jason Falls.
Or Jason Falls will be a great manager.
Because he can turn on the asshole if he needs to be. And it's, he told my wife that if Sweden won the World Cup a couple years ago, he was going to have Sweden tattooed on his ass. But there's another guy I know through a friend. It's through the other Brian. And he has a very close pal. And he's an attorney. And he works with a group that manages the Lumineers.
Oh, okay.
Or one of those bands in that genre.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if I've got that wrong. But like one of those guys.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you're looking for. So that's a fun game to play if you're a rock and roll nerd when you're sitting around with your friends over beers.
Peter Grant.
Who's going to be your Peter Grant? You know what I mean? Who in your friend group is the person that you would hire to be that person? Okay, so this is a funny anecdote, right? This all begs a different question, though, which goes back to the question that we were presented with at the top, which is, why is Dylan out there?
She finds him in Long Branch, and he's on tour at the time with Willie Nelson and Mellencamp, and is supposed to be playing in Lakewood, and those places are 45 minutes apart.
I saw that tour. Did you see that tour?
Nope.
I saw it here in Louisville, and I took my dad, and it was the first time I'd ever been offered pot in front of my dad, which was fun.
How'd that go?
We both politely said no.
We're not cool. Pass your joint over there.
I was like, do I have to explain to my dad what? And I was like, no, my dad is a baby boomer. He knows what that is. He also saw The Who in 1967 or whatever, as he likes to famously say. So he definitely knows what that is. Okay, so this is where Joseph's question comes back in play. Why is he 45 minutes away from the buses? It's not like he got off the buses in front of the venue and wandered into a neighborhood. So within a day or two of this story breaking in the press, someone clocks why the Long Branch neighborhood in Jersey might seem familiar to a music fan. And that is because the Long Branch, New Jersey, is home of the Born to Run house.
Oh, man, I love Born to Run.
Is that your favorite Springsteen record?
I mean, it's top three, easy. I don't know if it's the top one, but like definitely so. It's a big sister thing.
Oh, because that would fit right in the time period.
Because she knew Clarence Clemons.
That's right.
Because her ex-husband booked a concert with Clarence, and Clarence used to come to their house and sleep on the couch.
What?
Yeah. And hit on all their friends and other things that I'm not going to talk about.
As I would expect and want the rock star in my life to do.
So they got invited to that very first show for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, where they had it at the stadium.
Yeah.
So where Springsteen was the E Street Band was the pickup band for Chuck Berry.
Oh my God.
So she like got to.
So she was there?
Yeah. She was. So,
whoa.
And because of, she told me her favorite song was 10th Avenue Freeze Out.
Yeah, right.
And then that record is, that song's on that. And
yeah, so, I mean, Jungle Land is on that record. Thunder Road, which I know is the obvious choice, but it's such a great, I mean, the whole record is really, really good. Springsteen in general, it is hard. I mean, I'm a big Darkness guy. And I mean, Born in the USA, I've been listening to a lot recently, and as much as that's like the commercial record.
Yeah, and that was a huge,
it rips.
Huge commercial breakthrough record for me, but are there two songs on there that weren't singles? Is that right? I think that's correct.
There's a couple more than that, but yeah, it's not very many.
I think that the majority of the songs on that record are singles, and I think there are very few that aren't.
Yeah, wild.
It was a huge big record for him.
Well, and it's interesting, and I'm glad you're bringing up how big he gets by the mid-80s, because we're going back here to the late 70s to talk about Born to Run. Do you think, with the exception of Beatles and Stones maybe, is there another band or artist that you can think of who comes with the same amount of lore and mythology attached to them?
Well, there's Dylan,
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, that obviously works for this conversation. There's Bob Dylan. So, great point. Bob Dylan, Springsteen, Beatles, Stones. And anybody else?
Lore and mythology.
I mean, the amount of passion that people have around talking about
the
figure.
Well, I guess maybe Garcia.
Garcia. That's, yeah. Those are good ones.
And maybe the contemporaries of those bands. So I don't know. I couldn't tell you much about Fish or Widespread Panic or anything like that or whatever. But
right. That's cultish passion.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, there is a cultish passion to Springsteen, but it's almost not cultish because it's so widespread. Right? Because he was a cultish-like figure in a period of mass media, as opposed to a cultish-like figure in a period of, you know, like, underground.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So, I mean, he's a fascinating character to me. And yeah. To give you some context about why I even bring this up, or why I say that he's got a lot of lore and mythology attached to him, this is just an example. I read a portion of a book earlier this year, and I put the link in the show notes. It's called Mary Climbs In. That, of course, is a reference to Thunder Road. And the subtitle of this book is The Journeys of Bruce Springsteen's Women Fans. And it's basically an academic research paper about how Bruce Springsteen's music has affected women in the country. I only bring this up to say they don't write books like that about Vince Neil. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. There's not very many artists, maybe Dylan, maybe the Stones, maybe Jerry Garcia, maybe. But... No, yeah.
And there's no books about Jack Johnson, because, I mean, there's not a lot of heady stuff going there, even though, like, probably all women maybe like Jack Johnson. They're pretty happy about, get happy after a couple of mimosas with Jack Johnson. But there's nothing there of consequence of the depth of what. Our age is different, but did you have those live Springsteen CDs that came out in 85 that came out after Born in the USA? Like, that was, they dropped a three disc box set.
I have it sitting over there, I think.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. And I remember hearing that for the first time and being struck by the fact that, like, it was clear that he was a voice of a generation that I was unaware of. You know, that he tells the story about, like, he gets drafted and he has to go down and he fails his physical and has come back and he tells his dad he fails his physical and he says, well, good. Yeah. It's like, those are things, it's like, really? They're amazing things to hear out of a songwriter. And that is what, that and Born to Run and all that is what I'm wrapped up in, because I'm a woman secretly, and I love.
Well, that's the
Bruce
thing, though. Women and men. I mean, I think the reason that book gets written, right, is because it's obvious that Bruce is a figurehead to a lot of men of a certain age. But he also has that effect in an artistic way, not in a sex appeal way to women. Not to say he wasn't, that didn't exist, but he also had this real emotion. Like, there were a lot of women with an emotional attachment to his lyrics in a way that they wouldn't have had with a lot of the more general kind of sex, drugs, and rock and rollers of the time period.
The lyrics to Thunder Road. I don't know, man. They should carve that into something and put that somewhere.
Right. And, you know, I mean, there's been so much study over, like, what was he trying to accomplish with Thunder Road? And Thunder Road was this, you know, man thinking about growing up in the 1950s and creating a record that was full of nostalgia for two decades before. And, you know, there's, like, all of this stuff that is not, again, you know, even more than a feeling, you know, which is just a song basically about sex, right? Like, Springsteen was going so much deeper than that in so many ways. So anyway, we're getting sidetracked talking about Springsteen's influence. There's a million podcasts where you talk about how important Springsteen is. The reason I do all this is to bring some significance to this next part, which is the Born to Run house. Talk about that. What is that?
Right. The story goes that Born to Run came to Springsteen while he was lying in bed one night inside this house. He said, the title suggested a cinematic drama I thought would work with the music I was hearing in my head.
And he essentially ends up writing several of the big songs from that record in this particular house. That's, the lore, right? About there is actually a time and a place and a situation in which these songs come out of. And you need a little backstory to truly appreciate why this is important. The Springsteen Born to Run story, I love it. Because it's one of those classic, almost didn't happen stories. And this is the stuff that Rock and Roll Dreams are manufactured from.
Yeah, Springsteen was signed as a solo artist, and there was a lot of expectation and pressure with the idea that he literally is going to be the next Bob Dylan.
Especially pertinent to what we're talking about, putting these two artists next to each other in this conversation, right? And that is a lot of pressure, and it's especially hard for a guy who really doesn't want to be a solo artist. You see him fighting this most of his career. There's this book by Warren Zanes, who was in the Del Fuegos. Do you remember that band?
I do. I haven't thought about them in ages.
So he is now he works in music and stuff, but he writes. And he has this connection. They actually got to play with Springsteen once, and so he has this connection to Springsteen. And he writes this book, I think it came out last year, that is just amazing. It's called Deliver Me From Nowhere. And it is about the making of Nebraska, which is obviously a couple records after Born to Run. But he talks about the trajectory in that book of the career and the different things that are happening and some of the time around Born to Run. And one of the things that he says is that there is this aspect to Springsteen that never wanted to be on his own. Read that quote.
Yeah, it is a good quote that's related to that. Bruce Springsteen never studied a music industry how-to book in order to cultivate the E Street culture that grew up around him. His inner circle of bandmates and collaborators was the result of almost natural growth guided by Springsteen's instinct. No one really trained for the job they were doing.
In another spot, Zanes writes that Springsteen, despite his solo contract, where he's literally on a subsidiary of Columbia as one person, despite that, quote, was still raised under the sign of the Beatles. The being in a band mattered deeply from the beginning. And that is why, despite being signed as a solo act, he will insist on making those first two albums group affairs.
Right. Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey, and The Wild, The Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle. Those are those. They both come out in 73, and they don't sell well.
He's an East Coast act. That's the only place he really sells, is in Jersey and in the surrounding areas, right? And by 74, the label is losing interest because they have another guy waiting in the wings. They found this dude named Billy Joel, and they think he is going to be the next big thing, kind of what they thought Springsteen was going to be. And they try to convince Bruce to do something different. And they're like, listen, why don't you give up the E Street Band? Why don't you go to Nashville, because he's been recording in New York, and record with a bunch of session guys in Nashville, and we think, you know, we'll invest in that. That's the next and maybe last chance we're going to give you. And he says no. Bruce wants his band.
Yeah. Imagine when Ween were like, we would like to record our next album in Nashville with the best Nashville artist. So there's a lot of pressure on Bruce, and Bruce last shot at really making this work.
But
really.
We know what happens. In 2024, we know what happens next, right? After a long and arduous recording process, because he is a perfectionist, this record does in fact save his career in the sense that he gets to keep making music, and it becomes arguably among the most written about and canonized albums of all time.
Yeah, for sure. And it's easy to see why the house where it all started has become important as a place to stop by.
Right. So this is the turning point of Springsteen's career. He goes out on a limb. He insists on his band. He makes the album that will define him and then becomes a superstar. And he does it from this house. So that is the question. If we're going to careen back to the letter that started this whole conversation, is Bob Dylan a Bruce Springsteen fan? Is he a Born to Run lorist? Is he out there looking for this because he cares about that record? Was he looking for the Born to Run house on purpose on that day in 2009?
Yep.
Or is this all just a coincidence?
Right. There's sources on the internet that will include in this story that the house he was actually outside of was the Born to Run house, and it's not true.
Yes. So he's not there. So back to the original question, was he on Bruce Springsteen's lawn? It's not the house Bruce lived in, right? At that time. And it's also, it is not that house. That's not the house where they pick him up at. The Esquire interview, Officer Bubble, calls this out. She says, quote, I read some things after the incident that Bob was looking for Bruce Springsteen's childhood home. But it's not even in that neighborhood. It's in the west side of town. This where I picked him up was in the center of Long Branch.
So why would people think that Bob Dylan was looking for the Springsteen Born to Run house
and
to begin with?
To be far and not be there, to be blocks away or whatever.
Right.
So that's where this gets more interesting.
Yes, it does.
So if you just
I want Bob Dylan to adopt me. Because of this.
I will say, this is like, there was a point when I was writing notes and I wrote in the margins, one of us, one of us. Because this is that kind of story. Bob Dylan is a rock and roll nerd. Spoiler alert. And while we don't know 100% that he was in fact looking for the Springsteen house and just got turned around, there is some stuff that was happening around the time that definitely makes it look like that is probably what was happening. The reason people thought that might be what he was after was that he had a recent history of seeking out rock and roll related landmarks in the most casual ways possible.
And it's such an awesome thing to think about. So this is New Jersey 2009.
Yes, correct. And this next headline comes out of Canada in November of 2008. So we're going back almost a year. Okay.
Right. And across the border. Two, Bob Dylan turns up at Neil Young's childhood home for a tour. So let's remind everybody what's happening in this house he doesn't live in anymore.
This, let's be clear, not a museum. He doesn't show up at a museum asking for a tour. He shows up at a private residence and knocks on the door.
That's right. So this is from the article. John Kierman, who occupies Neil Young's former Winnipeg home, told CBC News on Monday that he was looking out the window a week ago Sunday and saw his wife talking with two strangers.
It happened again!
On the front lawn.
He was on his front lawn!
Yes. 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 And this is where, just the way the rest of he explains this is so awesome and cool. I'm looking out and I realize this guy has really great boots on, these sort of cowboy motorcycle boots, and he was wearing really nice leather pants. And then I realize I'm staring face to face with Bob Dylan.
Oh my God, dude. He'll go on to say that Dylan and his manager had what was a pretty unexciting visit looking around the house. And then he went off to, quote, tour other areas of the city. The casualness of this is hilarious to me.
Oh, yeah. We're just going somewhere
else.
Then
he's like, oh, let's just, I hear Neil Young's house or childhood home is around here. Let's just go knock on the door. And then we'll go, I don't know, see whatever else there is to see in Winnipeg.
Yeah. Speaking of Neil Young and Bob Dylan, you know about the guitar?
Wait.
Connection.
I think I saw this reference. Refresh me.
So it should be its own episode, specifically because of what happened to Hank Williams Martin. It's a D19, I think. Oh, yes. I'm sorry, yes. Everyone.
No, you're right. It's D19.
Don't punch me in the balls.
It's D19.
Being wrong about that. So there was a guitar that he owned, that Hank Williams owned, that's at the center of the story.
And there is a lot of rumor and innuendo specifically around this story. You're right. Maybe this should be its own episode. So some people think Hank Jr. inherited this guitar and then sold it for guns, right? That's the rumor.
That's a story. If you go to the Country Music Hall of Fame, there is a Martin that's there that Hank Williams Jr., it says on it that he kept it and had it and then donated it. But you know, Neil Young donated a D19 to the Ryman.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there's two. I'm guessing those are both Hank guitars because he did have more than one. They weren't just, there was a D19 and another one. I can't remember. But yeah, so apparently that was the deal, is that the rumor is that he just pawned it so he could get some guns.
And this comes from a couple places. Neil has told this on stage, but it also comes from this guy, Tut Taylor. Do you know this guy?
Only because the name, because it's such a weird...
Yeah, bluegrass guy who then opens a guitar shop in Nashville. So a lot of Nashville people know him. And he claims that he bought this guitar at this pawn shop where it had been pawned for guns. And then he eventually sells it to Neil. And I saw this quote in the research. This is from a Jerry Langford article about Tut, where he recounts Neil Young coming to his store. Taylor said he remembers Young's elaborate bus, complete with a spiral staircase leading to the crow's nest on top. I did not verify if that is a real thing in his bus, but I would love to know. Young held the guitar, then strummed an E chord. Quote, he said, "This guitar has soul. I named my price and he bought it. Young often tells the story of how he acquired this guitar during concerts, going as far as mentioning Tut Taylor by name.
Just crazy. The guitar nerd corners of the internet like to debate this and try to prove whether or not it could possibly be true. And that's all in the show notes. So
yeah,
enjoy.
There's a lot of message board people yelling at each other and comparing pictures and being like, this isn't that guitar and this guitar isn't this guitar and whatever, right? But how Neil uses this guitar is really interesting. So this is a little bit of a diversion, but recently on the show, we talked about Curtis Mayfield. And thank you to everybody who reached out after that episode. I knew it would strike a chord, but it was fun to hear from folks who were really excited to talk about their relationship with Curtis. And so we talked about how his very last record kind of belongs in this conversation with what Robert Christgau called one time the Nearness of Death albums. So I think we cited Mississippi John Hurt and Warren Zevon and Johnny Cash's American Six. But Neil makes this record in 2005 that I had kind of forgotten about when we were talking about that conversation that gets put in this category. Prairie Wind. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
It's like sort of like a return to Harvest.
Right. It's because of what was going on and what was he was playing.
Yeah. So he was undergoing treatment for an aneurysm and his dad dies all during this album's production. So it's like this reflection on his childhood and about what life means and all this stuff. Right. And that album was recorded on this supposedly Hank Williams guitar. And so it's very significant. Back to lore. I mean, Neil Young has not as much lore as Springsteen. There's a lot of lore around him. And this is very significant to that lore.
And if you try to look and find out and do research to see where else he used that Hank guitar, like, there's nothing really solid that tells you anything except that he played it all on this record.
Right. I mean, that's the one place it pops up.
Right. And to bring it back to the Bob Dylan of it all, here is a quote from Neil talking about this guitar. And this is a great quote. Bob Dylan was using my bus, and when I gave it to him, I told him that Hank was in the back, and so I don't know what he did with it, but he had it with him for a long time. And I don't know what he wrote or what he did, but you know, something must have happened back there.
So Bob Dylan's random visit to Neil Young's childhood home is in November of 2008. There's clearly a connection between those two artists. Now, this potential search for Springsteen's former abode is in July of 2009.
Yeah.
But between these dates, we get another story like this. This time coming not from the CBC, but coming from the BBC. Read that headline.
Yes, he is a tourist. The headline is Dylan Unnoticed on Beatles Tour.
So again, the threads between these stories is amazing. Front yards and anonymity, right? Like, people are just like, I don't know, some old guy kind of looks homeless. And the story gets a little closer to the New Jersey Tale because it has all of these characters who just have no idea they're next to Bob Dylan.
Right, right. If you go to Liverpool, you can take a minibus tour to John Lennon's childhood home. This was $20 at the time of the story.
And we know that it would cost roughly this amount of money because Dylan asks for no special treatment. If you're Bob Dylan, if you're Bob Dylan's manager, where is his manager? His manager who was worried about it.
Get out of the cop car.
His manager,
you copper.
He's not going to call the John Lennon museum people and be like, hey, can Bob Dylan come and see John Lennon's stuff? No. Dylan shows up, pays £16, gets on a tour with 13 other randos, and no one, except presumably the tour guide, notices that there is a different musical legend beyond the John Lennon of it all, sitting next to them and looking at these photos and looking at these documents right alongside them.
So why is he doing this?
Now, that's the million-dollar question, right? Both state news agencies reports that we talked about Canadian Broadcasting and British Broadcasting, who report on these stories about Neil Young and John Lennon, they immediately will draw these comparisons to Dylan and Neil and John. They're all kindred spirits. They're humble and unremarkable working class childhoods, blah, 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 blah. That seems like writers being writers, right? Working hard to kind of thread things together. But he does seem clearly interested, especially here in this later period of his life. Keep in mind, I don't have the birth date in front of me, but even in 2009, it was 15 years ago, he's approaching 70, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So he's getting nearish the end of his life at that point, and he's very interested in inspiration. Why does he have it? Where does he get it from? Where does it come from for others? How does it manifest? And the Hank Williams guitar thing plays into that, right? Ultimately, I think a lot of artists have no idea why they were able to turn what they do into a career while so many others can't. And what's really interesting about that Bruce Springsteen Del Fuego's book is there's a little bit of that happening in that book, because the guy was in this band that everyone thought was going to make it that didn't really. And then he is getting to sit down and hear about creation and chaos and inspiration from his one of his biggest idols. And so there's this like undercurrent that runs through that. It's a really interesting subject matter of, and I think just like us, again, one of us, Dylan is really fascinated by it. But back to the actual details of the original question. I just want your opinion. What do you think? On that day in 2009, do you think Dylan was looking for the Born to Run house?
Yes.
Yeah, I do too.
Yep. One thing we haven't touched on is this idea of who owns these pieces of lore now. Like in almost all these cases, except Lennon, which we talked about just a moment ago, they end up in private possession. They aren't museums or even marked, and so that is a reason that they could be hard to find.
Right.
Dylan could have just been turned around and in the wrong place.
Right. I mean, the Neil Young thing, right? Like, it's this random guy who looks out on his front lawn. So that I'm glad you brought that up. That's very, very true. So that's a really good point. And
I was hoping to get on a westbound bus, but I got to get on the eastbound. I'm lost.
So what's also funny about this is that it works because of who he is. It works both ways. Not only is he looking for the significant landmarks in other people's lives and careers, there's people out there looking for his. And so to kind of tie a bow on this, I have one more funny story. Do you have any thoughts or feelings about the actress Mayim Bialik?
Yep.
We're going to leave it at that? You want to leave it there?
Now, I didn't like that television show at all. I never watched an entire episode. And I really liked Trebek. And
So you're just not a fan?
No. I really, really...
Did you like Big Bang Theory?
Mm-mm. Never watched it. Never liked it.
Okay.
I will say it's not that I really dislike her. She just ended up in the middle of that awful Jeopardy thing where that one guy was put in charge of the search. And he's like, I know who the best guy is. Me. Welcome to Jeopardy. It's me. And it's like, all right, we'll let a girl host too. And to me, it seemed like it really devalued the fact that she's such an incredibly bright, super interesting person.
Oh, she's got multiple degrees and super smart and
But just man, I love Jeopardy. I'm 80 years old, dude.
I love Jeopardy too. My brother and I have gone through periods where we just like have long conversations about, hey, did you watch these reruns of Jeopardy that are on Netflix? So I feel you.
But there's a connection.
Yeah, so here's the thing with her. You mentioned that she's multi-talented. One of the things she's been doing over the last few years is making films and making podcasts. She's got a podcast with her current partner that's pretty good. But she was making this film about her relationship with her dad a few years ago, and she goes on Stephen Colbert to talk about it.
Yeah, and her dad was a big Dylan fan.
Right. And so she tells Colbert that once when she was a young teenager, she and her dad went to Hibbing, Minnesota to see Bob Dylan's childhood home, much like Dylan was doing to Neil Young's house and John Lennon's. And she's like, oh, hey, by the way, you know, as they often do when they're on this publicity tour for a project, she's like, I brought along some photos of me and my dad when we took this trip. So she pulls out this photo, and it's her and her dad, when she's much younger, standing outside of what she thinks is Bob Dylan's childhood home, and it's the wrong house.
Yes, it's the wrong house. It's great because was Dylan in front of the wrong house? Sounds like it. And so was she.
So when this happened, a local media personality from that area wrote this huge piece. It's in the show notes. You can read it. And they did a photo comparison, and they show, I mean, it's clearly not the right house. Like, Colbert doesn't point this out. Colbert just assumes, because she even says on the show, he asked something about it, and she's like, oh, yeah, it's not really marked or anything, right? And so they just snapped a picture in front of it all those years ago. And this person who wrote this article, after she goes on the Colbert show, does a photo comparison and shows that on a map and stuff, like she was probably roughly four blocks away. But I bring this up to point out what you just mentioned, which is she did it to him, and he's doing it to other people. This idea of, you know, being out in New Jersey in two raincoats.
Also in the show notes is an article from Atlas Obscura, and you should read that. It's about the correct Dylan childhood home address, which includes this paragraph. During his early stardom, Hibbonites, I'm going to assume that's what they're called because yeah. we just designated that's what they're called.
Shouts to all the Hibbonites.
Through his success was undeserved on account of his nasally singing voice and confounded lyrics. But these days, Dylan gets a little more recognition in Hibbing, with the high school and library creating small exhibits of his life.
Small exhibits. What do you have? What do you need that space for at the high school? Why does it have to be a small exhibit?
It's kind of like Hunter S. Thompson, like being from here. It's true. Like you can't, like, you know, let's name a wing after.
Yeah, that's true. We put him on the side of a building, but
and
still,
that's plenty apparently. For
yeah,
everybody.
Yeah, you're right. We actually don't honor Hunter S. Thompson enough in this town. I read that too, and I. Again, drawing back to biblical references of Jesus, not to get blasphemous or too serious in regards to Dylan, but just to borrow language to describe his experience, it's hard to be a powerful adult in a place that remembers you as a powerless kid. There was a prophet's never welcome in this hometown thing that Jesus once said, and I think about that when I hear that like everybody in Hibbing was like, "Oh, Bobby, nah." We never cared for him in these parts.
He didn't have a sexy singing voice.
No, but he did all right for himself. That was fun.
What a great letter.
Yeah, thank you for sending that letter. wearethestoryguys@gmail.com.
I'm glad we got to tie in some of the greatest people in rock and roll and guitars and rumors.
And Mayim Bialik.
That's
and
right.
Blossom.
And
all
Blossom.
In the same episode.
And Blossom.
Again, yeah, wearethestoryguys@gmail.com if you want to get involved. YouTube has got studio videos up if you want to see what we look like. I don't highly recommend it, but that's what the manager tells us to do these days.
But if you're more interested in learning even more, there's Patreon.
Patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories is where you can support the show $5 or $10 a month, get extra episodes and outtakes and newsletters and all that sorts of stuff. We really appreciate that. And then until next time, Murdoch, what should people keep doing?
Keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.